This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.
It's Wednesday, the 18th of June. This is your BizNews briefing. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. South African presidential spokesman Vincent Mgwenya says that President Ramaphosa has been consistent in calling for the de-escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Mgwenya says South Africa is aligning with one of Canada's priorities for the G7, which is the strengthening of peace and stability in all areas of conflict. He further reiterated that South Africa sees the United Nations as the most credible broker of peace when it comes to any areas of conflict.
For some time now, President Ramaphosa has been quite consistent in calling for the de-escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Part of that call was to ensure that this conflict that we've seen in Gaza does not extend to the rest of the region. And so one of Canada's priorities for this G7 is the strengthening of peace and stability, where we're going to align with the position insofar as calling for a peaceful resolution of all conflicts, Russia and Ukraine, India and Pakistan, Iran and Israel now. We will continue making that call that those conflicts have to stop. Those conflicts must be resolved through negotiation. And also to assert the point that there's no winner out of any war. What happens is the loss of life, destruction of infrastructure, the disruption of economic activity and supply chains. And so there's no winner in any prolonged conflict. And so we will assert that position. We will assert the position and the role of the United Nations as the most credible broker of peace out of these conflicts. And we will always offer South Africans support and assistance where it's required. And so that's the position that the president is going to assert, because as far as South Africa is concerned, there is absolutely no justification for this Iran-Israeli conflict, as much as there's no justification for the disproportionate amount of force that has been used against the people in Gaza, as well as the Palestinians in general. And so the president will continue asserting that position from that perspective.
Meanwhile, President Trump has reiterated that Iran should have made a deal with the U.S. prior to its Israeli airstrikes. Trump was speaking to reporters on Air Force One while returning earlier than expected from the Group of Seven leaders meeting in Canada. This in order to deal with the Israel-Iran conflict. Our Bloomberg colleagues have all the detail.
They've been negotiating. I told them to do the deal. They should have done the deal. The cities have been blown to pieces. They've lost a lot of people. They should have done the deal. I told them to do the deal. So I don't know, I'm not too much in a mood to negotiate.
President Trump speaking on Air Force One moments ago after he left the G7 summit early. The president also took to Truth Social, reiterating that he hasn't reached out to Iran for peace talks after he earlier denied that suggestion from the French President Emmanuel Macron. There was also some reporting from Axios this morning that Steve Witkoff would be meeting potentially with the Iranian foreign minister. So Trump potentially reacting to that, too. Joining us for more is Bloomberg's Horizons Middle East and Africa host, Jomana Bersetchi. Jomana, what do we know about why Trump left the G7 early and what it means in this ongoing conflict?
That's right. So we woke up to a flurry of headlines, the main one being the fact that President Trump decided to leave that G7 summit early. Later, the rationale given behind it was that he wanted to focus on the latest developments in the Middle East. But he then downplayed the prospect of reaching a ceasefire there in response to some comments that the French President Macron had made that there could be a possibility of a truce. Trump went on to say that they're working on something much bigger than that. And as we were just showing, the Air Force One just landed back in the U.S. and he said that if Iran wants to talk, they know how to reach me. They reiterate that Iran should have taken the deal that was on the table. And so this really is a critical moment because the whole world is waiting to see what sort of involvement the U.S. is going to have in the events that are unfolding. On Sunday, President Trump said that, quote, let them fight it out and see how things play out, i.e. more of a spectator role. Today, he's raising the possibility again of a potential to restart those nuclear discussions. Remember, the round six of those discussions were supposed to take place in Oman on Sunday. They were canceled. But now he's talking about the possibility of re-engaging diplomatically. And then, of course, the third option would be for the U.S. to get militarily involved and to join Israel in those airstrikes on some of those key strategic locations, the ones that we've been talking about, both those nuclear sites and the military sites as well, with Israel and the Israeli army saying militarily the last 24 hours, they feel like they are in a very dominant position. Now, the situation is very tense on the ground, and we also need to dovetail all of the headlines that I was just giving you now versus the other post that President Trump put up overnight warning Tehran residents, and by the way, there are 10 million residents in Tehran, to evacuate their homes. The airspaces are closed. They're going to be closed until 2 a.m. morning, another extension. There's nowhere for these residents to go. Traffic's miles long. People are trying to flee up to the mountains. So a very precarious and tense situation right now in the Middle East as the whole world waits to see what the U.S. are exactly thinking here.
For more Middle East analysis, retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula, Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Power Studies, discusses the escalation between Israel and Iran and how President Trump might actually respond. He speaks with Julie Fine and Joe Mateo on the late edition of Bloomberg's Balance of Power.
When it comes to specifically the nuclear facilities inside Iran, and if the answer is Fordo, can Israel take care of this without the use of U.S. bombers?
Well, first, thanks, Joe and Julie, for having me on. And I think you put your finger on, you know, just where the United States might be able to assist Israel in accomplishing its objectives. I would also offer my own editorial comment in that I think supporting Israel in its efforts to terminate Iran's nuclear capability is not merely a regional security issue. It's a decisive strategic imperative that would dramatically improve global security, preserve the international order, and deter nuclear proliferation around the world. Now, with that said, while the Israeli Air Force on their own can penetrate to significant depths by applying a series of strikes using their own penetrating munitions, the fact of the matter is very deeply and hardened facilities like the Fordo nuclear facility is upwards of 250 to 300 feet deep and located underneath a mountain. So that requires or would require, if you're going to use the air option, I mean, there are other means that might be used to disable that facility. But if you're going to use the air option, the 30,000-pound GBU-57, also known as a massive ordnance penetrator, is something that the United States could provide that could quickly damage that facility. So that's probably the biggest thing that's on the table right now. As it was mentioned in your earlier commentary, the United States is already assisting in terms of missile defense on the part of Israel, but it hasn't provided any offensive part yet, and this is where it could do the most work.
General, what is Iran's defensive capability after last year's attacks and what we've seen in the past 5 days? What's left of their capabilities?
Well, hey, Julie, great question in the context of the importance and the significance of the Israeli air attacks and their strategy, because it's a powerful and undeniable reminder that achieving air superiority is not a luxury, but it's a prerequisite for operational success and follow-on strikes and finally, you know, accomplishing the strategic objectives. With respect to what's left, we've already heard a declaration by Prime Minister Netanyahu that Israel's achieved air superiority. Now, it doesn't mean that, all the operations across Iran are that Iran's completely vulnerable, but there are certain locations and places that Israel can operate with impunity. There are probably some others that still have some significant air defenses, but Israel will deal with those. And so I guess that's a longer answer than perhaps you want, but, the short answer is they've pretty much taken care of the majority air defense threats, and they'll deal with the other ones that are remaining.
As President Trump says, we now control the skies. General, we've been surging an enormous amount of hardware into the region. We know the USS Nimitz is on its way. More than 24 refueling tankers have been dispatched to Europe, among other material and manpower that have arrived over the past many months here. The New York Times just this evening is reporting that Iran is preparing missile attacks against U.S. bases if the Pentagon, if the president does decide to get involved. Do we have the resources we need now to provide force protection for our bases in Saudi Arabia and throughout the region? Because that sounds like a much wider scope.
It's something that you would expect Iran to say. I mean, they're trying to prevent or deter action on our part. But the short answer to your question is yes. Our facilities and personnel in the Mideast are adequately protected by air and missile defense capabilities.
Do you believe that there is a point that the air wars can simply not accomplish the goal of the mission and it gets much, much larger?
No, I don't. I believe that we need to be careful not to conflate what most Americans, as well as military personnel for that matter, have experienced in the 20 years post 9/11, which were large-scale counterinsurgency operations with very, very different objectives than what we're seeing unfold in the Israeli-Iranian conflict. The fact of the matter is that the lethality of air power can be decisive in achieving strategic objectives. And I'd take you back to 1991, when we defeated Saddam Hussein's ground force of over 500,000 after 43 days of precision airstrikes. The only reason we needed to use surface forces was to participate in the Great Prisoner Roundup and then reoccupy Kuwait. But that's not the same objectives that Israel has in this particular campaign, which is to eliminate Iran's nuclear weapons development aspirations and capabilities. And that can be done principally with an air power strategy, along with small numbers of special operations forces.
Back home, the South African government, under land redistribution, has acquired about 2.5 million hectares of land that has not yet been transferred. This is the figure given by Wandile Shihlobo, the chief economist of the Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa. Shihlobo says the land is sitting in a government land holding account and has yet to be transferred to Black South Africans with title deeds. Let's dip into that conversation with BizNews' Chris Steyn.
And secondly, linking that with some of the land that the government has been buying, much of that has not been transferred to Black farmers with title deeds, which is why sometimes you drive around South Africa, you read the media, you hear about failing land reform farms. We don't get into details of why are those farms failing. We say, some of these folks don't know how to farm. These farms are failing. But the reality is that, amongst other things, we need to be clear on beneficiary selection criteria or what is that land geared for. And secondly, we have to ensure that we transfer the title deeds to some of the beneficiaries. Because as we speak today, the South African government, as an example, under land redistribution, has acquired about 2.5 million hectares of land. That is in the government land holding account as I speak with you. That land has not been transferred to Black South Africans with title deeds. When that process happens, we have to ensure that it's transferred to them, but it's also appropriately selected beneficiaries and transferred with title deeds, paired with blended finance, as well as the skills and the training that we may get from a range of commodity associations. This is important because land reform in South Africa has to achieve two objectives. It is restorative justice as well as economic growth, because ultimately we are faced with three problems in this country. It's higher levels of poverty, it's joblessness, and low growth. And anything that we do has to help us on resolving those. There are a number of myths associated with land reform. The fact that it hasn't progressed is one of those. The scale of how much land is owned by white farmers, it gets exaggerated to about 80% of the country. While it's not there, it's actually around about 50% or so. And also the fact that there's literally no black farmers that are there. Black farmers are there, but of course, their output is still small, at about 10% of the commercial agricultural output. I don't think many South Africans appreciate how big 2.5 million hectares is. I know we are a massive country. We're a country of about 122 million hectares. But 2.5 million hectares is big if you consider the amount of grain and oilseeds that we produce in this country. We produce it in about 4.5 million hectares. So you get a sense of how big for 2.5 million hectares, about half of that. So we can still do more.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Yesterday, Alex spoke to Rob Herzog, who says he is retiring from the spotlight. One of his parting shots was to suggest that the Democratic Alliance and the Patriotic Alliance should bury the hatchet and join forces in South Africa's political landscape.
My view is the DA and the Patriotic Alliance need to come together as one party. You know, if you look at their manifestos, of the 10 manifesto issues, 7 of them are identical. Identical. And they disagree on the margin. You know, the Patriotic Alliance are much tougher on illegal immigrants. They want to get rid of them all, chuck them out. Whereas the DA is kind of soft on that front. The Patriotic Alliance is way stronger in support for Israel. You know, John Steenhuisen did that pathetic, let's see what the courts say nonsense, which is rubbish. The Patriotic Alliance believes in the death penalty. The DA probably doesn't. But otherwise, the main 7 elements of PA and DA manifestos are the same. They're both Judeo-Christian, free market, rule of law, you know, pro-West. They need to come together and stop fighting and understand that, you know, the DA believes that the Patriotic Alliance is a kind of ANC Trojan horse. But they do that because they are head-to-head at the municipal level in the Western Cape and those sort of areas. The only threat the DA actually has is the PA in the Western Cape, not the ANC and not MK. So they've been bad-mouthing each other, I mean, non-stop, which is pathetic. I think they need to actually get together and work it out together.
On the US front, our Bloomberg colleagues spoke to Nassim Taleb. He's author of The Black Swan, and he's a scientific advisor at Universa Investments. Taleb says he doesn't think that the consciousness of risks has improved over the last 25 years. He discusses the increasing U.S. deficit and its impact for the United States over the longer term.
It started with Fooled by Randomness, where people don't understand the difference between noise and signal and mistake very often noise for signal. Things have gotten worse.
Yeah.
Okay. The understanding of tail events has gotten worse. Okay. The pricing of tail events, one would think, would be more rational. Has gotten worse, okay? People use bad models more and more.
Wow.
And so it is interesting. I saw that over a 25-year, you know, the life of my book collection, The Incerto, the first one being Fooled by Randomness. So I don't think that there is consciousness of risk that has improved. We just think that at any point in time that we live in a more risky period than our ancestors or that we did before. But it's just a normal perception. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. A couple of years ago, Mark Spitznagel over at Universa warned that this was a tinderbox time bomb of a situation with the U.S. debt load. And that certainly has gotten worse, but the markets have been pretty complacent to it.
So
is this time different?
Yeah, let's look at markets. Okay, markets are not driven by long-term economic stuff. It's driven by allocations. Okay, for example, people think that the market reflect today the impact of the tariffs and these policies that may or may not be rational. No, markets are driven by a certain allocation parameters, and people, of course, panic sometimes, but they got to satisfy these. In the long run, of course, the economy will decide, and we have severe problems. The first one being the accumulated deficit. It is snowballing, as you know, and with interest rates here, it is adding every year to the budget, so just to stay in the same place. Plus, what has happened with a lot of modern economies is that as you get richer, you see, it's normal that your growth rate would slow down because you have fewer people in poverty in your economy. You have to import, actually, poverty from elsewhere. Okay, it's like an S-curve, like a natural S-curve that we see in nature. At the top of the S-curve is when people borrow, when their growth potential is much lower, and for natural reasons. It's not nothing to do with policies. So we should be borrowing less now that we have reached sort of like almost reached destination, because the it's a what we call a decreasing growth rate, and which is normal, whereas countries in Africa and Asia are far away from that point. You see, they still have people in poverty that they got to pull up, and that will increase their GDP, and they can borrow, but they're not the ones borrowing.
And that brings us to the end of this BizNews briefing. We'll be back tomorrow with more context on both the local and global front. Thanks as always for watching.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.